Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Carolyn Yeager, who has a website at carolynyeager.com, but also other websites. And Carolyn, I know one of the topics we want to discuss and revolves around the Holocaust. I had a recent conversation with Gordon Duff, and I made that correction to the his name on the website for the Real Deal archives, in which I observed that the laws against Holocaust denial are simply absurd, because if you believe in the reality of the Holocaust, as I do, then you know that serious research is going to substantiate that belief, and if it doesn't, then we're certainly all entitled to know.
Very good. That's very good sound thinking on your part. And this is exactly the position of the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, which is the sponsor of my website about Elie Wiesel and his tattoo. Their position is simply, let's talk about it. Why can't we talk about it? See, it says open debate because we can talk about it in the United States. We have still have our First Amendment and free speech, but it's you can't really talk about it openly because immediately you will be hit upon by a whole onslaught of people who will attack you for wanting to talk about it.
But what does free speech mean? What does freedom of speech mean, Carolyn, if we can't talk about controversial subjects? I mean,
well, here's the interesting thing, Dr. Fetzer. You can talk about every controversial subject except this one.
And why is that? See, it seems so completely ridiculous, you know?
Well, it's been going on for a long time. But people are so convinced by, first they're convinced that it's all real, just as they said it was. And so they say, you know, and then that's one way that they're convinced. But they still might say, well, but if people want to talk about it, let them talk about it. But the Holocaust industry and the Jewish element has made a very, very successful effort to say and convince people that it hurts them. It hurts the survivors. It hurts people terribly to have people expressing doubt about it or to question any of the details about it. And so, therefore, it should not be allowed. And they have succeeded in causing people or making people go along with that.
Well, I'll tell you, when I was a young man growing up in Southern California in the 50s, we used to have a free kids show at the Rialto Theater in South Pasadena, where I went to junior high and high school. And in the old days, of course, you had a cartoon, you had a newsreel, you know. I don't remember the previews of coming attractions, but I sure remember the newsreels.
I do, too. they made a big impression.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I saw newsreels of massive bodies, you know, all these naked bodies being stacked up and tossed around like kindling in these death camps. Now, when I was...
Yeah, I didn't see those. I remember newsreels, but I never saw any of that stuff.
Oh, I saw it. It was really quite stunning stuff. And then when I was 15... my parents had made a trip to Europe, and they'd seen all these young people doing youth hostels and all that on bicycles. So they encouraged me to do that. So I saved money and one of my uncles chipped in. It was going to cost $1,000, and I had to earn my part of it and managed to put it together. And I wound up being in a group with a Student International Travel Association that went to England, Belgium, Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and France on bicycles. We actually sold our bikes in Switzerland and took a train across France to Paris. But when we were in Germany, the one and only day that I was under the weather, as I recall, we were in Heidelberg. It might have been Munich, but I think it was Heidelberg. And there was a side trip to Dachau. And I did
Dachau.
I did not go to that concentration camp because, but I have always wished that I had, so I could have seen for myself whatever there was to see. My fellow cyclists came back. I mean, I guess I was the youngest at 15, and the oldest was a 32-year-old secretary from Ann Arbor. Now, there were about 16 of us, and the other 15 all made the trip, and they came back with all the stories of the crematoria and all that. And I certainly, at that point in time, had no idea that this would ever become an issue of public debate or skepticism. And, of course, we see all these amazing films like Schindler's List and Sophie's Choice and all that that tend to carry a tremendous emotional weight. So, you know, I've always myself been open-minded as a general attitude because I'm a professional philosopher, and, you know, I just believe, and you have to consider all possible hypotheses and relate them to the evidence to sort out what's true from what's false. But I've just been astonished by the extent to which, I mean, that Germany would pass a law that would incarcerate someone if they denied the Holocaust just is beyond me. I mean, I just can't imagine any possible rationale for having such an attitude. Unless, as you're implying, it's actually on the order of a myth or a dogma, in which case maybe scientific research is going to tend to undermine the legitimacy of the myth or dogma, and it's going to lose its potency as a political weapon.
Well, it already has done that. Scientific inquiry has already undermined the legitimacy of the Holocaust as it's presented. And because of that, that's why they have these prison sentences. In 1986, you probably know the name of Ernst Zundel.
Yes.
He's famous. I suppose there are people who've never heard of him, but the media made him very well known. And he was publishing some things. He didn't write anything, but he published a book about questioning the number 6 million. And it had some other questions in there, too. And then some organizations got upset about it, and they managed to get him, get some charges against him for, inciting hatred into the masses or so on. And this was in Canada. And Canada has had some laws. Canada doesn't have a First Amendment freedom of speech like we have, but they think they have freedom of speech. Well, he went into court, and he had enough money, and he managed to get people to get, you know, give him money also. And he put on a very good defense. And during his defense, a man named Fred Leuchter went over to Germany and went to Auschwitz, Birkenau, and went into the so-called gas chambers there. Took samples from the wall because, based on his knowledge, he was an expert in execution and so on. Based on his knowledge, Zyklon B, which was the method of killing in these alleged gas chambers, leaves a blue stain on the walls where it's used, if it's used a lot, because it's made up of some kind of cyanide, potassium cyanide, or some kind of cyanide.
Yeah, there's going to be a chemical residue.
And it took all these samples, and of course, the only places where there was a lot of blue stain were on the known rooms where disinfection was going on, disinfection of clothing and mattresses and so, you know, personal items and so on. But in the so-called gas chambers where supposedly people were being gassed, there was none of this stain. And they thought this would be really be the, you know, it would really end the, this would really do it. They had terrific evidence here. Well, at the same time at this trial, they still were allowed to question the witnesses, you know, cross-examination of witnesses.
Sure.
And so these witnesses for the old Holocaust stories, the survivors who had written books and so on, they were cross-examined by the Zundel's attorneys, and every one of them was just brought to, you know, where their testimony was destroyed. And on top of that, a very famous historian, Raoul Hilberg, came on the stand to support the prosecution, I guess you'd say. Or maybe the defense called him. I don't know. But he was questioned on his statements in his book that there was an order from Adolf Hitler to murder Jews in these gas chambers at this, via the Wannsee Conference, that whole business. And he was forced to admit that he couldn't produce any order. That he said there were orders, but he didn't have any, there weren't any. And therefore, he ended up rewriting his famous book, you know, The Destruction of European Jews, and taking that out. And then he said from there on, he changed it to, well, there was a meeting of minds. It was unspoken, but everybody understood what they were supposed to do. And so they did it. Well, this was supposed to be a big blow, and Wiesel was exonerated. You know, charges were dropped against him or whatever. He won it. But they didn't give up. And, you know, because the media does not cover this kind of thing, because the media will continue with their same old story about the Holocaust, and from then on, it was not allowed to cross-examine witnesses.
You said you mentioned the name of Wiesel. Did you meet Zundel? Who prevailed in the case? I mean,
Zundel. Yes.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for correcting.
Yeah. Because we hadn't got up to Elie Wiesel yet, but Well, I have a friend who in London. I only met during a symposium I just participated in. In the UK, which was devoted to debunking the war on terror, where I, Ken O'Keefe from the Freedom Flotilla, who had disarmed several of the Israeli commandos, was our master of ceremonies, and I presented a talk on whether the wars in Iraq...
I'm aware of that, and you were there with Kevin Barrett and
Jillian Otsman. Yeah, that's right. And it was very interesting. I mean, you know, we hoped for a large turnout from the Islamic community, which did not occur. But we did tape it. We're turning it into two DVDs. And I hope it's going to reach a very large audience by that route. But while I was there, I visited with a friend I'd interviewed before on my show, who actually had lost an academic position because he had questioned the Holocaust. And to me, this is just absolutely unjust, it's irrational, and it's completely objectionable. And I just can't understand why a university of all places, which should champion freedom of thought and freedom of inquiry on all subjects, regardless, would take such a step. I mean, to me, it was...
Universities have changed.
Disgraceful.
You are a true academic from the tradition of that, you know, academics should be in, but you must be aware that universities have really changed. They've become very politically correct, and that political correctness, well, I'm going to say it again. I know it doesn't sound good, but the number of Jewish academics has increased quite a bit over the years, and there are many universities and departments and universities that are really under the control of these Jewish members, professors and heads of departments and so on, and they really come down on this kind of thing.
Well, just to offer some general reflections here, I published a book on the evolution of intelligence in 2005. And during the course of that research, I explored racial differences in intelligence, which are an evolutionary phenomenon. And it turns out that the group that historically has had the highest levels of intelligence happens to be Jewish. And, of course, if you look through the history of science and technology, you find that you know, Jews have made some of the most important, magnificent contributions to art and literature and science and technology. Einstein, Freud, Leonardo.
But let me interject, though, in my opinion, some of these may not have been as deserved as they have been made out to be, and that they are given the benefit of all of this attention.
They make
that claim, and it's not as good as they make out to be.
Carolyn, I have a PhD in the history of science and the philosophy of science, and I'll just tell you that in my judgment, it is a fact that there has been many of the most important achievements in the history of science have come from persons who happen to be Jewish, but. I also really only introduced it because I think that there's a tendency among more highly intelligent people to get involved in higher education and to have academic positions. So, I mean, the idea, and this was the point.
That's true, but once they do, they then give more and more positions to fellow Jews. I think that can be demonstrated.
That's an interesting sociological claim. I'll just say... During the history of my career, from 1970 to 2006, a 35-year period during which I taught mostly courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning at a wide variety of institutions of higher learning, including Kentucky, Virginia twice, Cincinnati, North Carolina, Chapel Hill, New College of the University of South Florida, and eventually the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota, I did not witness that. I mean, you know, I'm not saying... what you're claiming is false, but it would be, of course, an empirical issue to investigate and determine the statistics. I'll just say none of that was obvious to me. Now, it wouldn't surprise me at all if in certain areas like New York City, that there was a superabundance of persons who happen to be Jewish, you know, in high political positions.
Yeah. But, Harvard.
Maybe
California colleges.
Well, I take some persuading. I'll just say, listen, I spent my life in higher education, and I'm saying it never arose. Faculty talk about everything, okay? You know, among themselves, whether or not they're willing to take a public stand on controversial issues, they talk about all subjects among themselves, and I cannot recall a single conversation in 35 years at all these institutions and conferences and everything else that ever where that issue ever arose. And it seems to me if it were a bona fide issue, it would have. I mean, I'm talking about 35 years. I mean,
In all of this time, amongst all these faculty talking among themselves, did they ever talk about the Holocaust?
It would come up occasionally, and they, I think that there'd be a strong tendency to agree with me that laws against Holocaust denial are simply absurd. I mean, they're immoral. They're not just intellectually offensive. They're immoral.
What would happen, Dr. Fetzer, if you were still, if you weren't retired, and you came out and started speaking, saying that publicly?
Mind you, Carolyn, I do my homework, right? I'm not going to address the topic unless I've done a lot of research on it and am convinced of what I'm saying and can produce support the evidence that substantiates my views, as I've done in the case of research on JFK, research on the death of Paul Wellstone, research on 9/11. I would have a considerable distance to travel in terms of doing research on the Holocaust to put me in the position where I would make such arguments. But if I were in that position, I mean, my tendency is to say my piece. You know, I tend not to mince words. And if I believe the Holocaust were a fraud, I think it's highly probable, given who I am, that I'd be saying so and saying so in public fora. And probably, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if I would get a raft of criticism, but, you know, as I say, if I were to be in the position of doing that, it would only be because I'd done all this homework, and then I would adduce the evidence that substantiates my position. I was very troubled about these studies about the chemical residue in the gas chambers not substantiating the use of Zyklon B. That's very, very troubling. And if I had done that research myself or were more familiar with it, then it might inspire me to do more research. But, you know, as it is, I have my hands full with JFK 9/11 and Boeing stuff. I mean, but, you know, I mean, I certainly like to explore additional issues through the radio show, for example, and articles I publish and so forth. But so, you know, I mean, I'm very glad to have you on and others who have unconventional views, like Gordon Duff and a host of others. I mean, in my opinion, there's no point in discussing issues if they're simple or uncontroversial. Therefore, I am drawn to those that are complex and controversial. I mean, those are the only ones worth discussing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here we are.
Yes. Yeah, I guess I'm the same in that regard.
Your point about Elie Wiesel is very peculiar, though, because, you know, he, of course, is what, perhaps the most well-known Holocaust survivor in the world. And yet he's asked about his tattoo, because that's how all the inmates were identified, by their tattoo, by their number. And he seems not to have one. Is that the case?
Yes, that's the strong suspicion, because we have photographs of his arm, and there are more photographs on the where it says on the page there under the on the page that is titled "Where is the tattoo?" There's more photographs, and there's no tattoo visible there. So where is it? And he's been asked about it. He always says he has one.
Why doesn't he show it?
He won't. He always refuses to do so.
Well, listen, I thought it was all, they were all on the forearm. So here we're looking at his forearm. I thought it was in the inside of the left arm. And here we're looking at his left arm. And it's not apparent. If it's there, it's not apparent.
I believe that they were on the outside of the
outside. Well, that would probably make more sense.
Many people think they're on the inside. And you see a lot of people showing tattoos on the inside. So it's still a little bit confusing. But it's definitely on the left forearm. And a lot of people have had tattoos put on them, which aren't tattoos. So you have to be careful what you're looking at. But anyway, it's pretty well confirmed by revisionists that they did tattoo the people in Auschwitz, not the ones who just came and left and went somewhere else right away, but the ones who stayed there. And that they had a whole system of numbers, and it's known what it is. And so here we have Wiesel, plus the fact, Dr. Fetzer, that the number that Wiesel says belongs to him is documented by the Auschwitz and Buchenwald archives to have belonged to a man of the same name who was born 13 years earlier than him, anyway, in 1913. We have the testimony of another survivor who can prove that he was a survivor, who says that he knew this other Lazar Wiesel. He was a friend of his, and that he never knew this Elie Wiesel. And he says Elie Wiesel took this man's, his friend's identity and his tattoo number and even his book that he says this other man originally wrote, the book that Knight was taken from. That Elie Wiesel says he wrote that original book in Yiddish. It gets complicated, but I am uncomplicating it on this website, which is, if I might mention to your listeners, is at www.eliewieseltattoo.com, and the name of the website is Elie Wiesel Cons the World, so it's easy to just Google it.
And remember, spelling tattoo, there are two T's.
Yeah, two T's.
T-A-T-T-O-O-S. Actually, you might have heard me typing because I was going under concentration camp tattoos just to see if they showed, you know, the information about where they were imprinted. It says, prisoners from several transports in 43 had their numbers tattooed on the inner side of their left upper forearms.
See, but it wasn't upper.
Tattooing.
This is where you get lots of...
Yeah, upper, right. I would have thought it was a lower. I mean, near your wrist, closer to your wrist, not your shoulder.
No, it wasn't above the elbow. It was below the elbow.
Right, but, below the elbow.
This is it where you look this up and you have to figure out what you're looking at.
Oh, I
agree.
Even
the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum puts out lots of false information. So they're not authoritative because they're pushing their agenda. It's all part of the, if you have any respect for Norman Finkelstein, It's all part of this Holocaust industry, which wants to continue on and grow on, no matter what, you know. So truth is not important.
Well, this is very embarrassing. If someone as prominent as Elie Wiesel actually doesn't have the bona fides, isn't the person he claims to be, that's really quite stunning.
It is. And what's more is that he continues to be protected. And no matter what is said by, and this is not the first time, Elie Wiesel has been considered to be a fraud by many, many people over the years. But they're not people who count, you know, as to, if you are somebody who counted and you said that, you'd soon not count anymore. Because he is one of their mainstays. They've given him the Nobel Peace Prize, and he upholds the Holocaust, official Holocaust story. And you can compare this, Jim, you can compare this to your 9/11 conspiracies, Jim, to all of these things. They all function the same way, don't they?
Carolyn, we're gonna take our second break, and we're going to be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host, with my special guest today, Carolyn Yeager. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates and the top military commander in Afghanistan, David Petraeus, seem to be at odds about troop withdrawal, which is actually scheduled for next year. Well, investigative journalist Webster Tarpley is here for more. Good to see you, Webster.
Thank you. You
have Robert Gates saying, look, there is no question in anybody's mind that they're going to start withdrawing troops in 2011, whereas you have General David Petraeus saying, hey, you know, when it comes time, I'm going to offer my military advice to Barack Obama, and this date may not even be realistic. So who's really in charge here?
Well, in this country, generally, it's the ruling elite centered in Wall Street that's in charge. The question of Afghanistan is now bound up with the presidential succession and the crisis of the Obama regime. If you look at this interview with Petraeus yesterday, big David Gregory Meet the Press special edition, it's clear that Petraeus regards the 2011 July deadline to begin the pullout as something which is flexible, it's open to discussion, it's going to be, as he says, determined by conditions on the ground. Now, even what Gates is talking about is the beginning of a token withdrawal. The guy who really needs the withdrawal is Obama, because his political crisis is now serious, right? We just had this flap about the tensions between Obama and his base. Governor Rendell of Pennsylvania, who is an experienced Democratic politician, former head of the Democratic National Committee, says that Obama will face a primary challenge over the war if things keep going the way they are. Now, this raises the question of the presidency. Petraeus, in that interview, seems to deny that he's running for president.
He didn't seem to deny it. He ruled out the possibility of running for president.
He was asked, will you run for president? The answer to that, of course, is no. I'm not going to run.
Right.
I'm waiting for a draft. The big question is, would you accept a draft? And, of course, he doesn't want to be like Grant. I mean, Grant is a bad word in terms of failed presidents for these people.
The way things are going in Afghanistan, where you have the 2000 mark of NATO deaths there in Afghanistan, you have opinion polls continually decreasing, who would have wanted to run on the Afghanistan ticket?
Well, first of all, let's look at the machine that's now assembled behind Petraeus. Petraeus is a candidate for president no matter what he says, and he didn't deny it. He ruled out this vulgar process of running. He is the neocon candidate. He is the main vehicle of a neocon restoration.
What makes you so sure of that?
Well, because
he's denying
We've had all these appearances that he's made. He's gone to the American Enterprise Institute and received the Irving Kristol Award from the Kagans. He's been lionized in the Weekly Standard by William Kristol, Charles Krauthammer on television, Max Boot, Frank Gaffney. The whole neocon faction have come together around him. So he is the vehicle of this presidential candidacy.
Well,
now,
there's no doubt that they support him. But look, how can you say that you can run a campaign on one issue, especially when it's a foreign policy issue? If we look back at history, let's look at George Bush versus Clinton. People voted based on the economy. There's an economic crisis here in the United States.
Right, and Obama's a savior in the economic crisis.
I mean, that depends on who you ask, but how can you say that you can have a candidate who's only going to run on this foreign policy issue that's not doing very well?
He's going to run on the fecklessness and impotence of Obama as a failed president. And he'll say,
well, what
my
about
military
his
methods,
leadership?
Well, his military methods, of course, are decisive, right? He's the victor of Mesopotamia. Now, whatever happens in Afghanistan, of course, it's a lost war in military terms, you're right to point out. But at the same time, it is very likely that this is now going to be eclipsed by a bigger war, by the attack on Iran, which is now the talk of all Washington. Everybody's talking about the Atlantic Monthly piece about how Israel is inevitably going to attack Iran and drag the United States into a bigger war. The more the military emergency increases, and there's every indication that it will, the more Generalissimo Petraeus comes to the fore.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn, you know, this wouldn't be the only time that a Nobel Peace Prize had been given to someone who, I mean, if what you're suggesting is true, was undeserving. I mean, look at the Peace Prize being given to Barack Obama, who seems to be taking his bloody time getting us extricated from these wars in the Middle East that were launched in violation of international law, the UN Charter, and even the U.S. Constitution.
Either the Nobel Committee doesn't know what it's doing anymore, or it's just become so politicized. Because then we also had Henry Kissinger and,
God.
And was it Rabin who won one with the other, that winning, I mean.
Kissinger's a particularly strange choice since he may have been responsible for more deaths in the modern times than any other single individual.
Right, so people are really losing their faith in the Nobel Prizes.
No, I'm intrigued.
The other ones that, like you were talking about, you know, the scientific and all those, I think those are all, you know, deserved and on the up and up. But it's the peace and sometimes the literature prize, but often that's okay too. It's basically the peace prize they seem to be messing with.
Especially political. I'm starting to read about this Who's Afraid of Elie Wiesel. Was the name of the play actually Imagining Madoff, featuring Bernie Madoff, Elie Wiesel, and his secretary that
yes.
He threatened would never reach the stage. Has it ever made it to the stage?
No. The story tells you how they caved in because he didn't nicely say please don't do it. He said you better not do it. You'll see my lawyers. But they rewrote it. And they didn't put anything. They put something else on with different people, different characters. Oh, or maybe it was still Bernie Madoff and someone else. Yeah, it was Bernie. They put another play on out, not in Boston or in Washington, D.C., but out in the outskirts somewhere where they also put their plays. And it was had a different title, I think, and I forget now. I haven't read it for a while. And it was Bernie Madoff and some fictional rabbi who was active in Jewish affairs or something like that. And so that's how they did this.
Let me ask you this, Carolyn. I'm reading about the shadowy origins of night. I mean, how do you take 862 typewritten pages in Yiddish and reduce it to 120 pages in English? I mean, that's preposterous. I mean, the 120 pages would be like an appendix to an 862-page book. I mean, that's really...
Well, exactly.
I mean, that's very strange. And then I'm reading some of the descriptions about how he writes, and they're completely antithetical. He's got one where he's worrying over every sentence, every word, the meaning of the word it, for example, and the other he's writing in passion, eager to make sure he gets every page out. You know, he can't even stop and reread. I mean, these are completely different styles of writing. And I speak as
this
one...
This is the kind of...
Yeah,
okay,
I speak as one who has written books at five different levels of complexity, so, you know, I mean, I realize, you know, the very great difference that can affect the way in which you write, but my style wouldn't undergo this kind of transformation.
Well, he's also saying he's describing the same, writing the same book in these two different ways.
Yeah.
This is where it's really crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, he's writing the same manuscript. So
this is very disturbing.
Well, this is what you find with all of this. You know, I have gone to the trouble to look all this up, and you find that it's there. I mean, what isn't there? There's a very little there, but nobody ever has all these respectable or respected critics. You know, literary critics and so on, Jewish studies people and so on have done all this reviews and critiques of Elie Wiesel's work, and only one or two have come close to looking at some of these issues, but they don't go very far with it. And so I looked into this, and it didn't really take that long, and this I came up with this, and it's just that it's the failure of this man to live up to his legend is so incredible, and yet it's just ignored. You know, they just don't.
Let
now,
me just,
how many people will he pay attention to what's written here? Well, you know, see, none of them. We'll get just silence. We'll just get silence on this.
Let me mention three points that disturb me.
Okay.
The first is he's asked about the tattoo. What could be simpler than to show it?
Exactly.
What could be simpler than to show it? Student asks, do you still have your tattoo? You raise your arm and you show it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't say, I still have it on my arm, and say the number. You actually show it. So that is very troubling. Then you have this idea of this play, Who's Afraid of Elie Wiesel? Now, it's a suppression of thought and creativity to not allow a production to be even performed. I mean, look, they're taking an interest in him. Why should he be opposed to it? If he's the real deal, is just as I have observed about the Holocaust. If the Holocaust is the real deal, then, you know, investigate it all you want. You're eventually going to be drawn to the conclusion that it was a reality, if indeed it actually occurred, as we have been taught. And if it wasn't, if it isn't vindicated by research, then we all deserve to know. Same with Elie Wiesel. So the fact that he's taken steps to suppress this production, I find that very troubling all by itself.
That was because he didn't want to be associated, so he says, with Bernie Madoff. And, you know, he lost money to Bernie Madoff. And there's questions about all these people who were investing with Bernie Madoff and why they were, knowing that he was getting returns that really weren't, you know, average returns. They were much above average, but they didn't care about that as long as they were getting
that's an absurd.
This doesn't go too well with Elie Wiesel's.
Carolyn, that's an absurd attitude to adopt. He doesn't want to be associated with Bernard Madoff. He's already associated with Bernard Madoff.
Right.
he was an investor with Bernard Madoff.
Not only his foundation had millions with Madoff, but he personally had millions with Madoff, and he's so upset about losing it that he doesn't want to talk about it.
So that's very disturbing. And then, as you point out, you know, if he's got two different descriptions of the way in which he wrote the same book, you know, the completely different styles of writing and so forth, that is just calamitous.
Well, you find this throughout Elie Wiesel's writings and statements and so on. Contradictions. And they don't bother him. And you find this also, Dr. Fetzer, in all Holocaust survivor literature. And they don't bother anybody because nobody can do anything about it. I mean, you know, nobody can take them to court. Nobody can question them. Nobody can bring it up. And nobody knows about it.
I mean, if what you're saying is true, then Elie Wiesel is some kind of op.
Yes.
I mean, you know, he's a functionary for the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a political agenda. He, for God's sake, he might even be Mossad.
you said it.
I mean, it follows. If these things we're talking about are well-founded, and it seems obvious that the three points that I said have struck me are well-founded, because he could so easily show his tattoo, and he doesn't. he has no good reason to attack the play, yet he does. And the idea of having written the same book in two completely different, one a frenzied, you know, just kind of like a hurricane-style production,
right.
And the other very measured and sedate and deliberate. I mean, those can't both be true. So if he's saying the same thing about the one book, you know, unless, of course, one could argue, well, parts of the book he wrote in a hurry, and other parts he wrote at great leisure.
No,
it doesn't sound consistent.
Plus, he was on this in his memoir. He's talking about all kinds of things, and then he's going on this trip to Brazil for his newspaper as a journalist. And then he, in one paragraph, he says, well, during the trip, I was down in my state in my cabin, and I decided to write my camp experience, which he had made a big deal about waiting 10 years. He made a vow so he could speak for the dead and speak for the silent ones and speak for this. And then he just, in one paragraph in this book, he says, I was down in my cabin writing frenziedly. I typed 862 pages because that is what was given to this publisher in Argentina. That has been a known fact for some time. So, of course, he wrote this book in 95, I think. And he says, I when I was done, just in time for us to land there, but I couldn't get off the boat. And then this publisher, that he never thought of anything about publishing it yet, this publisher just happens to come on board while he's being held there, and he's talking to him, and he sees he's holding this package, you know, this manuscript, he says, which he wouldn't be parted from. And he says, what is that? And Weasel says, oh, it's I've written my story of my concentration camp experience. And he says, oh, can I see it? And he says, well, it's not finished yet. He says, well, I still want to look at it. So he looked at it. He said, well, can I take this, you know, and I might publish it. And Weasel didn't want to let him have it, but he did. And this is all in one paragraph. I mean, this is all it took.
This is the one and only copy of the.
The one and only copy. And a reader pointed out to me that since he said he was typing it on his little portable, and you know, another thing about Elie Wiesel is that he makes it. He said many times that he writes all his books in longhand. He's never written on a typewriter or a computer. He writes in longhand. But this one, of course, he was a journalist. He was in his cabin. He was writing it on this little portable typewriter. And he managed to type up 862 pages. It couldn't have been more than 2 weeks. He said he was going to be gone for 6 weeks. So if he was going to go and come back, you know, and be there for a while, I figure maybe, I don't know how long it takes that boat then to get to Brazil. But 2 weeks max. I don't think
2 weeks.
He's typing in a frenzy.
So we're talking about say 15 days. I on a good day when I have written some of my books, I might write 15 pages.
Yeah.
15 pages times 15 is not going to get us to 862.
No. No. None of it. None of it adds up. Nothing adds up. But. You know, it's like when it comes to somebody like Elie Wiesel and his stories, of course, I'm going to say this anyway, you have to have absolute proof. What would it be? Some person that comes up and says, I wrote that, and here's when I did it, and has witnesses and proof of all kind, and then maybe you could get people to listen to you. But well, even when they have brought proof about things, you know, like we were talking earlier about the walls of the alleged gas chambers and so on, even when proof is brought, it's dismissed.
Well, I know enough about authors' vanity to know that if you got an 862 typewritten manuscript, you're not going to allow it to be reduced to 120 pages. You're going to have too much concern for everything else that's missing. I mean, what's missing is 742 pages.
Well, he says now that what's missing is more important than what's there, and it speaks more loudly. You know, Elie Wiesel talks in riddles.
Why wasn't it published? Why hasn't it been published?
Because it's lost.
It's lost.
He
mean the publisher took it and all he did was publish the 120 pages? And
No, that's the 120 pages in English. The publisher published 245 pages in Yiddish.
Yes.
He was a Yiddish publisher.
Yes.
In in Argentina.
Yes.
And in this, he had a whole series. This man had over 100 stories from various survivors of World War II.
And okay, so he was specializing.
This was one of them.
He
published this in Yiddish, and then Elie Wiesel says that then he reduced it further to about 170 or so pages and gave it to Francois Mauriac, his French friend, who is also a Nobel Prize winner. who was encouraging him to write these memoirs. Well, that whole story is also full of errors and inconsistencies, which I don't think we can go into right now. But none of it, the whole thing is botched up, which is why this is only part one, and I'm going to write part two and probably have a part three.
Carol,
just on the story of this.
This is just baffling. I'm just completely blown away. I mean, this is bizarre. And why he wouldn't simply show his tattoo is just beyond belief. I mean, you know, he's got to whip it out and display it.
He never has.
That's ridiculous.
It is. Which is why we make that the basis of the whole challenge. We call this our Elie Wiesel challenge. And the basis of it is the tattoo, because, as you say, it's just the simplest thing in the world. All he has to do is show it, but he doesn't have one. And people say, oh, he will write, he'll get a, you know, he'll go to a tattoo artist, and they'll put that on there, and then what are you going to do? And I say, oh, you know, I don't think he's going to do that, because the number A7713, we have all this other proof under the evidence on our menu bar that shows that this number belonged to a different person. And also, Dr. Fetzer, Elie Wiesel says he was in Auschwitz and Buchenwald with his father, Shlomo, from the beginning. And his father died at Buchenwald in February. And his father's number was A7712. Yet this number, A7712, belonged to the brother, the older brother of the man who had A7713. And there is no record of Shlomo Wiesel or Elie Wiesel with his birth date at Auschwitz or Buchenwald. They have, the only record they have is of Eleazar Wiesel, which is the same name as his, but with a very different birth date. So, and all these Jewish people are going along with this story and trying to, hold it up, and keep it together, and they're getting, making themselves. And one of them is Ken Walzer, who is a professor at University of, where is he? In Wisconsin? No, it doesn't come to my mind, but somewhere like that.
What's his name? I'll do a Google.
Ken Walzer.
M-A-L-T?
No, W-A-L-Z-E-R. W-A-L-T-Z-E-R. Well, I have it right here.
Ken Walzer, American historian, professor, current director of Jewish studies at Michigan State.
Michigan State, okay.
Yeah. He's done work on Buchenwald.
He's writing a book. Yes. He's writing a book about the orphans of Buchenwald, which Elie Wiesel was supposedly one. And he's got all these, he claims Elie Wiesel is in a picture, you know, leaving Buchenwald as a young boy. And I've got a page.
Oh, he's writing a book that's going to substantiate Elie Wiesel's story?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Well, they all do.
Very
interesting. This is why I have the, this is why I say a lot of the things I do, because I know that they're all conspiring to hold together lies. And you can't call it anything else. They think they can say all they want, well, it's for a good cause. That's what they'll say. If they ever really get caught red-handed and have to admit what they're doing, they'll say, well, it was for a good cause. You know Simon Wiesenthal?
Yes.
He died not too long ago in his horrible Nazi hunter center, where they're still going after these old 90-year-old guys and trying to, put them on trial. And he's, what's I going to say here now? A book came out, which by a reputable historian, which showed, and they admitted in there, that he had lied about so many things, just like Elie Wiesel, lied about so many things. But then this author and the press and everybody, you know, they say, well, but, you know, he did it in a good cause. He was.
Oh, I love it.
That nobody else was doing. He was bringing. He was
the end justifies.
Hiding around somewhere here and there, and so we overlook these faults of his. But I mean, he's destroyed people's lives over and over and over again with his lies, and so you can't overlook it. Anyway,
and the one we're speaking of now, who's destroyed people with their lies, is who?
Well, Elie Wiesel has not destroyed people's lives to the extent that Simon Wiesenthal. Simon Wiesenthal.
Yeah, Simon Wiesenthal.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it suggested that there's Jews are not supposed to speak ill of other Jews, but I find that difficult to imagine. I mean, you know. Those I have known seem to me to be just as critical of other people as anyone I know. So, you know,
you probably know the Jews who are far more assimilated and not so networky. But there are the Jews. I don't mean to be, you know, making blanket statements about all Jews. But the Jewish power structure, let's say, that runs all these innumerable pro-Jewish organizations and pro-Israeli, and they tie it together. You know, they tie it together that all Jews are going to support Israel. If you don't, well, you know, there's a problem. We're going to come after you. So it's hard to separate Zionists and Jews. You know, in this way about what their agenda is.
Because I've looked up something here about the Jewish view on gossip.
Okay.
And it says that by gossip, this is in relation to the Torah, means prattling pointlessly about people, simply uttering neutral, non-damaging facts, I guess can be included. The Torah uses the Hebrew word rechilut, rechilut, peddling for gossip, buying, selling, and trading worthless words wherever you go. By lashon hara, the Torah means repeating negative truths about others, the most damaging form of evil talk. And by defamation, the Torah means repeating negative untruths about others, rumors, innuendos, secondhand stories. Of course, saying negative things about people doesn't make them in and of themselves false. And the question here, this needs to be close to some conventions for what are known as speech acts that have been well investigated by a fellow named Grice and another philosopher named Cyril, including, for example, that it's conventions of ordinary conversations that you should stick to the point and you should not, you know, say too much and not say too little. And you shouldn't say things that you know to be false, nor things for which you have no evidence. But those are perfectly general conventions of speech act. It's like this is a very primitive formulation of a speech act theory applied to gossip. Of course, what's the fun of gossip if you can't say things that you don't know are true?
Well, we shouldn't do that, and I shouldn't do that, and this shouldn't be a matter of fun. Sometimes, you know, amongst friends, it can become fun, but publicly, it's not about fun.
You know, here's a translation.
It's serious because they're accusing a nation of crimes that they have not proven.
Here's one. It says, if you're in a situation where someone says something bad about someone, either find something positive about him to respond with or politely smile and say nothing. Bear in mind, though, that listening to negative reports, true or false, will negatively affect your view of the person it's about. So you're better off just excusing yourself or politely changing the subject. If you're really strong-minded, though, you should try to drive the new impression you've just got out of your head. Well, this is about not being affected by gossip.
But
the points you're making,
Fetzer,
yeah.
You know, one thing is that when if you're referring to the Torah, and especially to the Talmud, when they talk about people or they or them, they're talking about other Jews. They're very often they non-Jews are not included in these rules.
Well, wasn't nice my conversation with Gordon Duff, I was talking about this book called The King's Torah that's so popular in Israel right now?
Yes.
Where the King's Torah says, you know, basically that the value of non-Jews isn't remotely comparable right. to the value of Jews, and that you're even entitled to kill non-Jews even if they're innocent, if there's the possibility at some point in time they might pose some kind of threat. I mean, it conjured up the vision of these Israeli Defense Forces shooting innocent Palestinian kids, you know, just...
That's how they justify it. And because they think that if they are under threat, God allows them everything to protect themselves.
That's God does. And it's such a bizarre... Everybody thinks
God... In the Old Testament, the first five books, the Torah, you will find that most of what they give as far as moralizing or how they should behave right to one another... is to other Jews, and non-Jews are excluded from that, as I already said. But I wanted to be sure I made that point.
Well, it's not the first time. Yeah, it's not the first time I've encountered some of these themes. I was active in the Evolution in Human Society organization for some time, we had the members of the group were doing research on group strategies. That are evolutionarily beneficial to the group, and one focused on, you know, Jewish strategies historically to benefit the members of their own group.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.